everybody, and welcome to the last episode of The Sediment, the official ASPN podcast. Today, we're going to cover the sessions that we all heard and witnessed on Monday. This recording is happening on Friday, so I bet all of us are having PAS/ASPN withdrawal right now. We have a great group of panelists with here today, and I can't wait to jump in and discuss all those exciting sessions that we had on Monday at ASPN. So without further ado, let's start with introductions. My name is Sudha Garimella. I am an associate professor of pediatric nephrology at University of South Carolina in sunny Greenville. With me today are wonderful moderators slash speakers at Monday's talks. We'll start with Dr. Kate Perry.
So yes, my name is Kate Wesseling Perry. I'm a pediatric nephrologist and professor of pediatrics at UC Los Angeles in California. And a fun fact about me is that I share a name with a famous singer, and I also love to sing, but I will not sing for you because that would hurt your ears.
That is actually a question I had for you, is that, well, you know, with going by your name, can we expect a concert?
You'd prefer not, really, trust me.
All right. Next, we have with us Dr. Bradley Dixon.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brad Dixon. I'm an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Colorado School of Medicine and Children's Hospital, Colorado, and I'm a pediatric nephrologist. And a fun fact about me is that I am a marathon runner and have completed 5 marathons in my life.
Oh my goodness, that's amazing. So how long do you have to train for each marathon?
About 6 months.
6 months. Oh my God. Well, I walked a half marathon for my 40th birthday, and believe me, I'm never doing it again. But kudos to you. That is an amazing commitment. All right. So, and we also have with us Namrata Jain. Dr. Jain.
Hi, I'm Namrata Jain. I'm associate professor of pediatrics, recently transitioned to Hackensack Meridian School of Medicine in New Jersey. I'm a pediatric nephrologist, like all of us. And fun fact about me, I guess I have many facts. I'm not sure if all of them are fun, but I don't run marathons. I'm probably a 0-mile marathoner, but I do love to kayak. And I found that, you know, wherever we've gone on vacation, when I have ever gone for my interviews and resident fellowship, I always was trying to kayak or canoe down the rivers nearby. And you can go on the same river multiple times and still learn so much about the animals and the creatures and the habitat. So I've always loved kayaking.
Wow, that's wonderful. And actually, right where you live, I think my only experience of any rafting was at the Delaware Gap. When I first moved to America, it scared me a lot. So never again. You guys are way more brave than I am. All right. And then last but not the least on our panel today, we have Dr. Abby Bauer.
Hi, I'm Abby Bauer. I'm an assistant professor at Oregon Health and Science University, pediatric nephrologist like all of you. And I don't know how you've done multiple marathons. One was enough for me to never want to do one again. But my fun fact is that I used to play flute at weddings as a side gig in college to make a little bit of extra money.
Wow, that's amazing. So
I'm not good. I'm not that good. People just don't know any better, to be clear.
Well, I highly doubt that. Nobody's going to hire you for a wedding if you're not good. But through the sediment, I've come to know a lot of our community of pediatric nephrologists, and I am convinced we can all get together and make a great kidney band or orchestra. We have a lot of musical talent amongst our practitioners. All right, wonderful. So let's start with what went on Monday at ASPN in the first session of the day, bright and early at 8 o'clock. We all got together to talk about something that we have probably been talking about for 15 years now, FGF23. And it is high time we had a whole panel session about it. So it was a very good choice, I thought, for ASPN to put as a workshop / session. I get the terminologies mixed up. Dave Zalewski is going to kill me. But it was actually a session, not a workshop. And so I'm going to ask you, Kate, what did you hear during that session that you would say is, you know, that's advancing the field? What do we know now that we didn't know when we started looking at this molecule?
Yeah, right. No, we had an excellent session on Monday morning. All four speakers were excellent, really state-of-the-art researchers in this field. And when we first discovered FGF23 way back in 2000, so it's been about almost 20 years even, this was a hormone that regulated phosphate homeostasis in the body, caused phosphaturia, and was known to cause hypophosphatemic rickets. And on Monday, we heard all about all the other effects of FGF23 on the body, including effects. Dieter Hofner went through how it's made, where it's made, its effect on bone. We heard Josh Nagatnani talk about the receptors involved in its signaling cascades and work she's doing to elucidate exactly what is going on between FGF23 and heart disease in mice models. We heard Michelle Denberg talk about new studies that are ongoing to attempt to change outcomes in terms of FGF23 in chronic kidney disease patients, because we know they're high in our patients and they're not causing rickets in our patients, but they are causing adverse cardiac and infectious outcomes in our patients. So she detailed ongoing studies in that arena. And we also had Farzana Perwad from UCSF giving us the very latest on the use of the anti-FGF23 antibody for patients with hypophosphatemic rickets. And I will have to tell you that that data in patients is probably the most striking, welcome data I've seen in a long time with this molecule. It's really changing the life of these children with rare bone disease. This isn't our community of CKD patients, but the possibilities from this this therapy, this antibody therapy, really deserves further study in our population as well.
Right. The applications for it based on that one genetic disease model to all of our population with especially the cardiovascular outcomes was the most exciting thing for me, because we've always been talking about how, at least, you know, in the adult world too, death and morbidity from kidney disease is usually cardiac related. So it feels hopeful that we have something to offer them in addition to all the great stuff we do for their kidney health, that now this is something that's going to impact cardiovascular health.
I find it very hopeful also. And I also will say that all four speakers were so very well considered in presenting the pros and cons, because of course, chronic kidney disease is not hypophosphatemic rickets. And this antibody in mouse studies of chronic kidney disease had were not all positive. The outcomes were not all positive. So there's a little bit of a question there whether it's going to benefit our population. But I have to say that I think it's a very exciting field.
Right. I remember one of your speakers had put up the pros and the cons of the therapy and wondered if like one set cancels out the other set. And so we really don't see any clinical effect. But can you tell us, what do you think is most likely to reach practicing nephrologists the soonest? Do you have a guess as to which therapy would be the most impactful?
Well, you know, I think that the antibody therapy really for now is the space for it, really is in patients with normal kidney function and hypophosphatemic rickets. I really do think that's really where the space for that is right now. For chronic kidney disease, Michelle Denberg did such a great job of talking about the interplay of FGF23 with other systemic issues going on in chronic kidney disease, such as anemia and such as heart disease. And she talked about therapies that could modify all of those at the same time. Mm-hmm. As for different phosphate binders that are coming online or that are online right now that deserve more investigation, such as ferric citrate, which mm-hmm. has potential to work through the iron side and also the phosphate side to lower FGF23. So I really think that that in chronic kidney disease is where the in the short term, at least, the best benefits are going to be seen.
Yes, I agree. I think ferric citrate was so elegant. I think that speaks to all of us as nephrologists, a therapy that kind of, you know, one stone, different birds, so to speak. So that was an excellent session. And I think we had a very good discussion at the end of it with a good, a hearty Q&A session too, where I learned a lot. It is not a topic that you hear about on a day-to-day basis, but I think for us in the scientific community, this is a field that has offered hope for a while. And I'm just excited that finally things are coming down the pipeline. All right. Well, talking about something that we haven't talked about for a very long time, because this disease has not existed before the pandemic began. Let us switch gears to talk to Namrata Jain about the COVID-19 session. So it was a given that we were going to have a COVID-19 session, right, for our first back in-person conference during the pandemic. But let me ask you this. With all of our experience since the pandemic began, what kind of kidney diseases are, cropping up again and again clinically for children infected with coronavirus?
That's actually an interesting topic. Dr. Abby Basilelli did a wonderful review, including her own paper that she published in March 2021. And she had seen 157 patients, 11.8% of them had AKI. 9 out of 10 of them had resolved their AKI by the time of discharge, and many of them had decreased systolic function on their echoes. Mm-hmm. They had actually also found an increased odds ratio in Black children, almost threefold, in those who had AKI associated with MISSI, or multi-system inflammatory syndrome. And right 1 month afterwards, our fellow Marissa Lipton and also Ruchi Mahajan at Columbia, in my prior group, we had published in a smaller report with 57 patients. So we had about 40-something percent AKI percentage, 61% had resolved their AKI day two. And most of them, 90%, were better by the time they left. We did have one child that needed dialysis. The group with Dr. Basilelli did not require dialysis. There's also another study from Dr. Gruwell in Michigan, and they had published and having rates closer to 40-50% in the AKI. But again, all of those kids had done well. So, you know, most of these kids came in with dehydration, potential NSAID exposure prior to that. In the Columbia group, we did see also decreased, systolic function on the echoes, but we also saw differences in procalcitonin levels as well as lymphopenia and decreased changes in CRP levels compared to those who didn't have AKI. I do think what's interesting is Dr. Basilelli, in addition, she talked about the difference between the alpha and the delta variant in a paper that was published more recently, and there wasn't a difference in AKI in that population. They did follow up on those kids 6 months afterwards, and on those who had echoes and their AKIs had resolved. But I think it's very, very interesting that we're learning that at least the kids that we saw, none were super sick. But yes, we did have one kid who needed eculizumab, and we published that in the Journal of Nephrology last year as well. The other thing I want to bring up is COVID-19 associated nephropathy, or COVIN. Mm-hmm. And some people liken that to HIVIN or HIV associated nephropathy, which we know has a very high 30 to 90 increased risk of collapsing FSGS associated with APOL1 mutations. And we're finding that also in COVID, that those who had SARS, if they have a predilection or a carrier for G1, G2, they can have increased risk for COVID as well.
Right. Yes, I take care, unfortunately, of a young man who has that. So it was just horrifying to watch this completely healthy teenager now, ESKD. It has real impacts, even though it seems strange to talk about long-term effects for a disease that we've only known for 2.5 years. But I think we're seeing that across the country popping up here and there, lingering effects from COVID.
No, for sure. We actually just biopsied someone last week who presented with elevated creatinines and actually had SARS-CoV-2 at the end of December. And a third of her glomeruli showed the collapsing FSGS pattern. The remaining showed an acute TIN. You can also see tubular interstitial nephritis associated with SARS-CoV-2 as well. And this child, her creatinine was going up to 3.4, and we ended up treating her with steroids and was able to bring her back down to 1.1, but she's eight and a half years old. So we're waiting for her genetics to pop up. So we'll see if she is an APOL1 risk carrier. But I think we're learning, unfortunately, about so many things about COVID and, you know, trying to help protect our kidneys and our children with their kidney disease. And who knows with the different variants, if each will affect our patients' kidneys differently.
So here's a question for the entire panel. Now that we know the high rate of AKI and the effects on the kidney from COVID, are all transplant centers across the country requiring vaccination before transplantation? What are you all requiring?
We're requiring it here. And I think in the general area, the Northwest and North California, everybody that we've talked to is all requiring it as well.
Same in New Jersey.
Southern California as well. Yes.
Yes. Same here in Colorado. Yep.
Right. So it's the same here in South Carolina, but we do get a lot of pushback from families about that. So I think that with the pandemic, we've all become great advocates for child health. And this is one other area in which nephrologists are taking the lead. Speaking of taking the lead, right, early in the pandemic, I just want to mention that we also had all those questions about ACE inhibitors and whether they were actually hurting or helping when somebody had an acute infection. And if I am right, it was nephrologists who kind of led the research into that and decided that it was okay to keep our patients on ACE inhibitors and ARBs, right? Namrata, just back me up on this.
Yes, I think there's papers coming from our adult colleagues looking at that. You know, obviously, if someone is having a acute AKI, we always generally tend to hold ACE inhibitors and let that part go by. But if someone was on it, you know, for chronic issues and for renal protection, you know, hopefully if they were hydrating well and they didn't have a demonstration of acute AKI, then I think, you know, it showed that it was safe to continue on your medication.
Perfect. And then one other question I had, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, but is there a national registry? Are we following these kids like the cardiologists are following the MISC kids?
You know, I actually don't know the answer to that. I'm unsure if the rheumatologists are doing that. We were posing this question in my session since we were wondering that perhaps the kids from Columbia and Cohen's Children's Medical Center from which and Michigan, from which those pediatric MISC AKI studies came from, to see follow-up data on how they're doing. We don't have follow-up data. There was 6 months follow-up, but we don't have a 1 year and later a 3 year post to see have any of those developed chronic kidney disease. And that was posed at our session in terms of a discussion point for future study.
Perfect. Yes, I remember hearing that too. So I do think we should, we are having a lot of these children across the country, and I think they deserve to be studied. So that's a great idea that came out of that session. All right, we're going to awkwardly switch gears now to the TMA session. We have Abby as well as Bradley with us today. So I'm excited to have both of you. And I think the session was excellent and was also designed to talk about newer therapies. So let's start with you, Dr. Dixon. What should we be expecting to change in how we approach these diseases?
Yeah, well, I think we had a great session with very nicely complimenting, pun intended, talks that focused on atypical HUS, C3 glomerulopathy, and post-transplant TMA. And the underpinning of complement with all three of those diseases. And I think a common thread running through, at least from a therapeutic perspective, with each of those is the advent of newer complement-targeted therapeutics that that are currently available to us, as well as those therapeutics that are in clinical development. In the AHUS section, Larry Greenbaum gave a wonderful talk on the ideal properties of a therapeutic for AHUS that certainly eculizumab and ravulizumab have shown to be highly efficacious in that disease, but have their own drawbacks, being intravenous agents, having some degree of frequency, increased risk for meningococcal infection, and so outlined the ideal properties of an agent that would be the next level, the next step in treating patients with AHUS. And fortunately, he, and towards the end of his talk, covered a number of agents that are not yet clinically available, but are really coming to the fore from clinical trials, targeting nodes in the alternative pathway like factor B and factor D, other ways of targeting C5, the complement protein C5 that is not intravenously administered. So there's a lot coming down the pipeline for of these complement targeted therapeutics. And many of these agents will ultimately be used, will be explored with AHUS after being shown to be efficacious in diseases like PNH, where often that's the starting point for these therapeutics to be used, or C3G.
Right. So obviously the nomenclatures have changed over the years for all of these diseases, which is another nice thing that we like to do ever so often, keep things fresh by changing all the nomenclature. But C3 glomerulopathy is definitely something that we are, we've not had great therapeutics for after we started identifying it better. We still were, the same old therapeutics thrown at it. So it was good to see that there were other more down the cascade, more directed therapies available. So Abby, question for you is, do you think that what sort of clinically, like for practicing nephrologists, what do you think? Is it still going to be start with something more broad like eculizumab and use these targeted therapies for people who are failing those treatments? Or are we envisioning where we have perfect genetics and we can identify the where the mutation is and then we just, boom, hit it with the right therapy?
I think we're, it would be great if we got to either of those, right? And I don't think we're either at either yet. And I think it was actually a really great question from one of the people in the audience was about like, what do you start with? And they had a patient that they had on mycophenolate and they were like, when do you stop this? And I think, genetics is, I think it was you that wanted to point it out, Dr. J. But, I think genetics is still in its adolescence, but I think that's going to be a game changer for a lot of these diseases, just to help us understand, like, what should we be predicting will help you? What will be the best choice? And so I think once that's figured out a little bit better, thank you, Dr. Dixon, and all of those of you looking at that, I think we're going to have a much better handle on it. And, the thing that really struck me was how many medications we were looking at for C3GN and for AHUS. And I think one of the things that always just like, if the same medications work, how similar are these diseases? I mean, they don't even look remotely alike, right? But
exactly.
I just think that was something that I thought about a lot afterwards, for sure.
I think there's a lot that we still don't completely understand, the complex interplay between the various pathways of the immune system. And, researchers are the people who are going to lead the charge so that clinicians can follow and take better care of our patients. which is what is great about a conference like ASPN, which brings everybody together. So sometimes the Q&A sessions in these scientific sessions lead to the next question that researchers have, and that's their next grant. So yes, you're all welcome. We'll ask the questions. You get the grants. All right. Well, that was a joke. We'll edit it out. All right. So is there anything after listening to the session, and this is for everybody who was in that session, that would change, that you would recommend we change management right now? We're definitely using eculizumab and ravulizumab. Families always have this question once they've responded, how long? Do we do it lifelong? Who is it who can come off of therapy? Europe's been leading the charge in that, but what do you advise families?
I can start, take the lead on this question. And, you know, that the answer is it's very patient and family dependent. You know, I think it depends on a lot of things, like, as Abby mentioned, the underlying genetic milieu. There are some genetic factors that have a very high risk of relapse after discontinuing complement-targeted therapeutics, or predict severe relapse when the medication is stopped. And so the genetic background may be a factor to consider, whether the patient has gone into remission from AHUS affecting their native kidney versus a kidney transplant. So that may change the math a little bit. And then ultimately, how much comorbidity does the patient have? Do they have residual, severe, or advanced CKD related to their AHUS presentation, where a relapse would be much more likely to put that patient over into ESRD? So I think there are a number of factors to synthesize when you're making an individual decision with a family about how long to treat and when to stop. And I think it's also worth saying that in patients where therapy is discontinued, one thing that I always offer families, especially if they're if these patients are still making urine, is to teach them how to dip urine at home for hematuria and proteinuria as an early warning system, really giving them the empowerment over their disease more so than just based on laboratory monitoring by the clinician alone.
Yes, I think that's a great idea. And I think we also have a pediatric nephrologist at Atlanta who's developed an app for home urine testing. So shout out to them for, you know, all the innovators in the field too. So I think that Monday's sessions were heavy on the science, I will say that, but it was also heavy on hope, because we, in every field, everything that we heard on Monday, it is that we have new therapies for families. There's never a disease process where we say, this is it. We can't, you know, do anything more than this. We also had a rare diseases session earlier in the conference where we've had some good news for cystinosis and other rare diseases too. So adding that onto these complement-mediated diseases and looking at FGF23, I think you'll all agree with me that the future of families, the future for children who are dealing with kidney disease, is getting brighter and brighter every day due to the efforts of researchers. Thank you so much for coming on, everyone.